Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning with us, well, as I said in the email to him, it happens every spring. Our guest is S.C. Butler, Sam Butler. Stay tuned. Thank you. That's me screwing up the software, but it's all Duke.
Thank you.
And you're tuned. Are you tuned? You're tuned. I'm not. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. I am so, like, uncoordinated because whenever Sam Butler is on the show, we're having too much fun to bother about. Right now we were talking about my Murph. My Murph is the name of my phone, which reminds me I have to silence it. I was the first time I got this, I had put it into my shirt pocket where I normally keep it. And every time I get an email message, it speaks out loud. So I have it in my shirt pocket, and I'm talking, and I was actually eulogizing.
Eulogizing his phone.
I was eulogizing Cage Baker. This was not a happy thing, you know. And so I really was eulogizing. And as I'm doing that, you know, the phone being approximately, Sam can see, about 18 inches from the microphone, just says out loud, Murph. What's the name of the brand? Is it Moogle? Is it Moogle? The Moogle Murph? Is that the name of the phone? Yeah, I mean, I could say the name. It says its name on the air. But I figure I love my phone. I will promote it. It's what we were just talking about. And not liking things made out of fruit. And
No, but boycott fruit. Boycott electronic fruit.
Really, really, and what they have done over the last 2 weeks alone?
The stock price is insane.
I'm talking about their business practices and what they've done with Adobe and all that.
They own Adobe now?
Appalling. No. Very briefly, because it's not the topic of the show, but very briefly, what they did is Adobe came out with their new software, CS5.
Okay.
The Creative Suite 5. This is $2,000, $3,000 software for developers. If you get the very high end, other people just get Photoshop
or
whatever. But the whole Creative Suite, CS5, came out a week ago last Monday. And one of the big features in it was that you write an application in Adobe Flash or one of their languages, they give you a feature that will allow you to port, you know, create that same application for a Droid or an iPhone or this or that. The Friday before Adobe comes out with that, Apple changes their rules for their developers, saying thou may not use a language which is not basically under certain standards. And what those standards are is it's anything but Adobe.
Right.
The day, the 3 days before the new software is released to developers, thereby, so they're not just saying you can't use this to develop stuff for the iPhone. It would appear that this is an intentional shot, not across the bow, but right to sink the software, to stop
below
developers.
The waterline.
It's below the waterline to stop developers from actually purchasing the software. So you know to develop stuff on the iPhone.
Do they have a competing software package? Is that what?
They don't have their own. They are going toward HTML5 instead of Flash. They won't put Flash on the iPad or the iPhone. And of course, YouTube runs on Flash. A lot of the web runs on Flash, and Apple is saying, well, not our web. But this has always been Apple. Has always been
about control. They want to control it's the direct opposite of what the original IBM philosophy was when they said we're going to release the specs to the world.
Open source.
Open source, right.
Yeah, it is the opposite of open source. It is proprietary. It is what journalists have started calling now a walled garden.
Yes, yeah.
And one can see.
It kept me out of iTunes for a long time.
Well, yes, exactly. And I just won't personally, I just don't personally allow any Apple software because there was a time when I had QuickTime on my machine,
right.
And lo and behold, I had Safari. I never downloaded Safari. My opinion is, what is the definition of a Trojan? Something that opens a door for other software, unwanted, unsolicited software to come in. It's not malware. It's not nastyware, but it's this whole thing. So anyway.
Which I, as not a computer person like yourself, have been sort of learning about lately because I'm trying to write this science fiction novel now, which basically involves an alien Trojan, or whatever you want to call it, alien malware as the actual original way of making contact with a new way.
That would probably be a virus.
Yeah, it's probably a virus.
What a Trojan is, very simply, it's like a Trojan horse, which is to say it's something that disguises itself as something else.
And this would be a straight virus, which doesn't – it just infects. It comes in on, radio astronomy. The signals radio
it's
astronomy
viral
picks
software.
Up. It's viral
well,
software.
If it's pretending to be something else
it's
when
not
it comes,
pretending. It's piggybacking.
Okay.
It's piggybacking, and then once inside the systems, it starts to replicate.
Viral.
Yeah, I refer to this. I refer to this project as Contact Meets the Moon as a Harsh Mistress.
Oh, I like that.
Which is so we'll see if I can pull it off or not. As a primarily fantasy writer, science fiction is a whole different mindset.
Yeah. And let's introduce you. Let us. Sam Butler writes under the name
S.C.
Butler, and I'm very careful because now I'm doing because if you say S.C. Butler too quickly, it can be S.E. It's not. It's
S.E. Butler. I'm the famous S.E. Butler.
There you go. And the trilogy, fantasy trilogy, with a W.
Oh, now you got me thinking. The Stoneways trilogy.
The Stoneways. Okay, I'm picking up the W
the second,
from Ways.
The second syllable, yeah.
Yes, exactly. The Stoneways trilogy, which is just this wonderful I wouldn't quite call it YA, but I guess some people would.
Yeah, it starts out as YA, and it's even
– And it grows up.
And it grows up, but even though they're YA, they're still – Even the last book, the main protagonist is YA, but it's not. I wouldn't.
But
call
it's
the last
not
book
really
YA,
young adult fiction. But it's. In that sense, it's like Heinlein. You wouldn't call The Moon is a harsh mistress young adult. Although today, if they were marketing it, they may very well call it that. They may very well. Mike is young, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, the whole thing with Starship Troopers, which was written as a YA book.
Absolutely,
but they decided. Oh no, this is much too harsh and realistic for YA, Yet, as you say, what was too harsh and realistic for YA in 1963, 62? Actually, I guess it's even earlier than that.
I think it's
60 or 61.
Yeah, I think thereabouts.
Would be a day at the beach.
63 is Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Just before that is Stranger.
And somewhere in there, too, is my least favorite Heinlein book, Glory Road, which I just reread.
That's a nasty piece. It's
the beginning of Heinlein as I'm going to spout at you.
Yeah.
Even though it's a short book.
Well, he always spouted, but he started spouting nastily. He started spouting.
He didn't integrate it in the story. The story becomes the spouting.
Because Methuselah's children has enough spouting in it.
Right. But it's more integrated.
Yeah. And it's sort of bearable, and at least at the same time, he's telling a good story.
Right.
But he stops telling stories, and by the time he gets to Time Enough for Love, he's not telling stories at all. It's just anecdotes.
Well, and you know, you meet people. Jim and I are of a certain age. We are actually born the same year. I'm not sure I'll mention that on air. But if you find people younger than we are, and you mention Heinlein to them, all they think of is the nasty old super libertarian Heinlein of the later books. And they have no idea. I mean, I literally had a conversation, went out to dinner with, Brett Cox and Alan Datlow and I don't want to say anybody else's name because I might be misremembering. But there was somebody there who was, I don't think, 30 yet.
Okay.
Who... When Brett and I started talking about Heinlein and Heinlein juveniles, and she just made the face, and you looked at her and you go, don't you like any Heinlein? And, oh, no, it's all terrible. And I said, and I don't know whether it was Brett or me looks at her and goes, or it might have even been Ellen, have you ever read anything written before 1970?
Yeah, that's the, yeah.
And
or the short stories.
Or the short stories. And she had no idea this other stuff existed. But
yeah.
Actually, I shouldn't say that. She knew it existed, but she just assumed it was all like the later stuff, which she would have encountered as a 14-year-old.
And I can't blame her. You can't blame her at all. But when you try to get the people to realize that basically the trouble with Tribbles is Heinlein,
yeah,
which it is,
right?
I think David Gerald would acknowledge that. And when you're dealing, and the wonderful stories like Magic Incorporated,
oh yeah,
Waldo, those are published together as one.
And my favorite time travel story of all time, By His Bootstraps.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anson MacDonald.
Yes,
with one of his pseudonyms.
Yeah, and was done as a fabulous, fabulous radio drama.
Oh, I'll bet it would be great.
I will give you a copy. It was done by this fellow out on the West Coast, Yuri. I'm blanking on his last name, but did a wonderful production starring Richard Dreyfuss, and Richard Dreyfuss. And then, oh yes, there was a cameo though by Richard Dreyfuss, and I played that on the air.
Oh, that must be
and
great.
And somebody said, Jim, that's the best reading you've ever done. And said, no, that's Richard Dreyfuss. But, of course, if those who are familiar with the story, By Your Bootstraps will be the same voice many times over. And people have claimed that there is a similarity between my voice and Richard Dreyfuss at certain times, maybe on my best days and Richard Dreyfuss's worst day. I don't know. There's apparently also a certain laugh that I can do that he does, which is that sort of kind of.
there, I heard it there.
Yeah.
Well, and I must say, I can certainly see you making Devil's Mountain out of mashed potatoes. I can see you.
You know,
with that
I turned on the TV last night just briefly, and there was that scene.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on TCM. Yeah.
But, it, you know, it's a strange thing. You know, you mentioned Glory Road and the different mindset for fantasy and science fiction. And I think that's one of the reasons that Glory Road is so bad is because Heinlein did not have a fantasy mindset. It was just alien.
Magic Incorporated.
Yeah, but
it's a different kind of
it's
fantasy.
A different kind of fantasy.
It's not heroic fantasy.
It's not heroic.
That's...
You know, there's lots of different kind of fantasies, and there are lots of different kinds of science fictions.
Yeah.
And there is a cross-fertilization somewhere in the middle, but you get the extremes.
And one person who writes fantasy very well when he puts his mind to it, who's a science fiction writer purely, Larry Niven.
You know, I'm not...
His early magic stories, the ones where Mana is a confined. Have you read those?
I don't remember them that well. I don't
the
think
magic goes away. But it's the title of one.
It's fantasy with a science fiction explanation.
Absolutely.
And that's
he creates
right there. It's different.
Science fiction rules.
Yes.
In a fantasy universe. But who also does that to a certain extent, although not quite as scientific, was Zelazny.
Yeah, Zelazny would definitely do it too.
And that's why his fantasy, that's why
his fantasy works.
It works so well. And right. And he walks that borderline. The first time you read Lord of Light, is it fantasy or is it science fiction?
Right.
I say the first time you read it, it's fantasy. The second time you read it, it's science fiction.
Right. That could be true. Another guy sort of does the same thing is Farmer. Philip Jose Farmer, you know, there are quite fantastic elements to a lot of his science fiction and a lot of his fantasy.
The World
has
of Tears.
Yeah, a lot of his fantasy has very.
I don't think he was consistent.
Oh, consistency was not Philip Jose Farmer's middle name.
No. But Zelazny, when he knew where he was going with something, as long as the publisher didn't change it, like when he was writing the Amber trilogy.
Oh, which became the
quintuplet, and there would not necessarily be a sequel. There would not be, you know, another book, much less five more books.
Right.
And this was actually at the there was a day where I did a 5-hour interview with Roger Zelazny, where he came to the station and gave me the whole day. And my God, I need to find that tape. At that time, he told me the story of the Amber Trilogy.
And what originally was?
That it was to be the trilogy, but there was enough of a word count, and the publisher, you know, drew it out, and thereby, you know, then came the second series of five books, which he had never planned on.
Well, I mean, and, you know, but this is the nature of the business.
This is his best-selling stuff.
Yeah. But that's why they did it. That's precisely why they did it. To a certain extent, in a lot of genre publishing, once something becomes successful, you see this all the time. What follows it, you know, there's huge pressure on the writer to follow it up, even if the writer doesn't have any ideas for that world.
Mm-hmm.
But the writers, you know, you're writing for money, you're writing for an audience, and your audience, by the very fact that it has become successful and you can make money on it, you know, the audience wants it.
Yeah.
And the publishers are much more attuned to that.
And
than
that's
a lot
certainly
of
what
authors.
Happened with Amber.
Certainly what happened with Amber. Fantasy is very prone to this.
Mm-hmm.
One would make the argument with Niven, whom we just met before. Have any of the last three Ringworld novels been any good at all?
I gave up after Ringworld. Yeah. I mean, the Ringworld Engineers was okay,
but
even then, it's not a classic. It just isn't. And Ringworld is a wonderful, wonderful,
wonderful
book. And anybody who's read it, I haven't read it in 20 years, and I can tell you all about Louis Wu and his motley crew and all that. I've read Ringworld Engineers and some of the later books in much more recent times. I don't remember a thing about them.
Right. No, they're not as memorable because, you know, actually, Ringworld Engineers, he had to write because they found the flaw in his math in the first one. And, you know, you just knew that after Niven heard that, he had to write something to explain it. From that perspective, it is a brilliant idea. It's not carried off anywhere near as well as the first book, but it is at least brilliant in conception.
Yeah. But the first book is brilliant in story.
In story. The first one is
brilliant. That's the thing. You know, it has...
It's got the wow.
It has the wow. It has mythic elements to it, very much so. And you're introduced, if you're not familiar with his known universe, then you learn about the puppeteers and the Kazin and all these... His universe is a fabulous, wonderful place. It's a mythos.
It is a mythos. It's a wonderful world building. And that's, you know, it's a lot of what you, and that's a place, world building is a place where fantasy and science fiction meet.
Yeah.
Because so often the best of each, even though it's done in completely different ways for completely different reasons and in a lot of ways to evoke a completely different feeling in the reader, the world building is still key to both.
So after after you built the world of the Stoneways trilogy, where have you been going? Because A year ago is, I think, when The Magician's Daughter just came out in hardcover, right?
Yes, and it's not actually coming out in paperback for another year.
Wow.
I heard
that's a long time.
It is a long time. And my understanding is I heard an explanation that makes sense.
These are from Tor Books?
These are from Tor Books. Tor apparently – you know about the Borders Return scandal of about – a year and a half, 2 years ago?
Vaguely, not a lot.
Borders, which is a company that even though they – I think they actually announced a profit recently, you know, one of the two big bookstore chains in the United States. They've been having serious financial difficulties.
Well, there's three really. When I Barnes & Noble, Borders, and Amazon.
And Amazon.
Well, but I guess people don't tend to think of Amazon as a bookstore anymore.
Yeah, I'm talking about bricks and mortar.
Okay,
very good.
The
bricks and mortar stores. And Amazon actually is not that big a – piece of the market. I don't think Amazon even has 10% of total book sales in this country yet.
Really?
No. It's excuse me. It's a lot smaller than you'd think. There was just a, and I'm quoting, I think, a number out of the New Yorker article. It was a New Yorker article about the whole pricing on ebooks. That's very interesting.
Oh, that's a fascinating article.
Very interesting article. But Borders has been having major financial problems, and of course, it was only exacerbated when we had the crash in 08 and all through 09. And Borders had been over-ordering books for a while, and it came to roost, and they basically sent almost all their inventory back to all the publishers.
Oh my God.
At some point in, I think it's early 09.
I hadn't realized that.
And what that did is it caused a real clog up in a lot of different publishers' systems. So, you know, they had to work through the extra inventory that came back. It created cash flow problems for the publishing companies. And what I've heard is that in order to deal with this problem, one of the things that Tor found itself with a backlog of – they had too much inventory. To deal with it, they didn't put out – they delayed a lot of mass market paperbacks and some trade paperbacks by as much as a year on their releases. So it's – you know, as we're saying, it's a business. And, you know, if you got to make money, you got to have cash flow. Otherwise, there will be no books. There will be no – great new world building and places to go and adventures to see. So that actually isn't coming out in paperback for another year.
So what is in print right now?
All three books are still in print.
Yeah.
You know, the first two in paperback and the third one in hardcover, and they're all in Kindle. And actually, you can get them on iPhone apps and things too.
They're in different ebook formats.
They're in a number of ebook formats.
Because I try to not just like I talk about my Murph. I try not to promote any one brand. So I know people are likely to do that
right.
With the Kindle, but hey, there's the Sony ebook reader, which is very nice. There's the Nook.
Yeah, and I don't mean to promote one or another. It's just it's the one I'm familiar with because my
– And it's nice. Yeah. Your wife's a librarian.
My wife's a librarian.
Yeah.
She loves it. She can read a book in the train by and large. She's that fast reader. But
just out of curiosity, has she tried any? The others?
No, she has not.
Okay, see, there's and I'm not saying that the Kindle, you know what, they each have their strong points. The advantage of some of the others is that they take multiple formats.
Yep.
And the Kindle is really much more of a proprietary thing. And in my mind, the Kindle is to books what the iPod is to music.
It's an
entryway into a store.
Right.
Having said that, it was the first that I ever saw of the e-print technology, the ink on a machine.
Oh, right.
And the digital ink, that's what they call it, digital ink. And the first time I saw one, I went into a store and with Barbara, and she and I see this thing. And we thought, oh, too bad there isn't a working model because that's just printed right on there.
Right, right.
And touched it, and it changed. Yeah. And that was a heck of an introduction. But that's on a lot of different machines now, with many more coming out this year.
And the thing I'm waiting for, what I really wanted in ebook, and I'm not sure it's there yet. I don't want an ebook that does everything. I'm a bit of a Luddite on this. I want you remember the size of an old 60s, 70s paperback?
Mm-hmm.
You know, 100,000 words, 180 pages, about what was it? It's probably 4x.
I was 180 pages, right? Yeah,
four by six and a half, 4x7, and it was always 180 pages. Whether they had to squish the print in tiny or make it big, I would love something that size that I could stick in my jacket pocket. I mean, a lot of this has to do with being a New Yorker, and always, you know, and not carrying stuff around. I don't want to carry a big bag or a briefcase or anything. I want to put stuff in my jacket pocket. And my memories of reading. I mean,
within 2 years, such a thing will exist. I mean, you can use a Murph.
You can use a Murph.
But it's, you know, and
but
and
it's
you can
too
look
small.
At Atlanta,
it's too small.
It is too small.
It's too small.
Because my previous, before I had the Murph, I had a pocket PC. And it had a nice large screen. I got the Murph because it's a larger screen than an iPhone and better resolution and all that. And I find it easier for ebooks. And there are other tablets, many coming out.
Yeah.
And before there was the iPad, there was the Arcos. And 10 years ago, there was HP had a tablet. So the iPad, to me, isn't a great ebook reader, and you can't carry it around.
No, I mean, it's far too big. It's far too big.
Yeah. So, yeah, you need something that will fit into a pocket, right. That's why, by the way, paperbacks were often called pocketbooks.
Yes. And, in fact, there's a publishing company called Pocket Books.
There is.
which is very bizarre because now they make hardcovers. It always comes back and bites itself.
And I will have to come back to that a little later because, you know, a former editor at Pocket Books is now the landlord of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And I will have to announce the John Ordover.
Oh, I didn't know that.
John Ordover is the landlord of the Soho Gallery of Digital Art, where, oh, God, yes, I will also have to announce that they are going to be hosting a Nebula Awards dinner in New York. A very strange thing. So the Nebula Awards will be held in Florida.
Yeah, I was
going to
say.
So what they are doing is that at the same space where we do the readings at the gallery, you can come in. There will be a buffet dinner, and they will webcast. Well, the Nebulas are webcast to begin with.
And you can heckle all the winners safely because they won't know you're heckling them.
They're going to have at least one, probably, I think. Two nominees.
Oh, okay.
Present. Certainly Nora Jemison, who was on the show not long ago, and N.K. Jemison will be there. And I'm predicting that one nominee whose wife just had twins.
Oh, okay. I don't know who that is, but
I don't think Saladin Ahmed is going to make it to Florida.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, it's going to take a special babysitter for that whole weekend. So he's on the cusp. But one way or the other, so they're doing the Nebula Awards there.
The Satellite Nebula.
The Satellite Nebulas. And that's, I think, and they're doing it officially with SUFWA. I mean, SUFWA is broadcasting the webcast, but this is an official SUFWA event. So you can stay in New York and have the 2D experience.
Yeah, 2D, and in a lot of ways, you know, we're such couch potatoes now. We're so used to watching sports on TV rather than actually being there. The 2D experience seems like the natural experience, the natural one.
And you haven't been to the new space yet, have you?
Nouchet? Is that what you're talking about? Oh, no, your new space. No, not.
No, for my new space.
No,
for
you're
the
not.
New York
I have not been to the new
readings.
Space yet.
Okay,
I have not.
Yeah, I have to show up. And our next May 4th, I think it's Tuesday, May 4th, will be. You see, I'm talking so many things at once.
Right.
I'm blanking on the names of my writers. Greg Frost.
Oh, right. That's right.
Paul Witkover is curating.
Curating.
And he read, actually, in January. And John's been on this show. Author of Gray, has a new novel coming out. He's an iPhone developer. I mean, I can name his software is called Mondrian.
I'm thinking somebody else.
He has his own podcast where he interviews writers. I have to go look at my own. This is embarrassing. And he's going to be on this show soon also.
We're getting old.
In the fall. Yes, exactly. So it's all setting in. But that's on May 4th, so everybody should come to that. That's on Tuesday, May 4th.
And yeah, I haven't been to your – I haven't been to
– You haven't been to the new space yet?
I haven't been to the new space. I haven't been to KGB since. I've been missing the readings lately.
That's right. That's right.
It's always – something's always coming up. So I got to get to one soon.
Yeah, and Rick Bowes and Jeff Ford were at the last one.
That's the one I wanted to go to, and I was not happy that I had somebody else scheduled that day.
And Nora Jemison was the month before, and Next month is Terrence Taylor.
Oh, that's one I would definitely want to go to. I definitely would like to. Terrence does some wonderful. Is he still writing mostly horror?
He's doing Nasty Vampires. His second novel is just out. The first novel was promoted by Whoopi Goldberg.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In People magazine.
Oh, man. I gotta go check
somebody
his
was
sales.
Interviewing Whoopi Goldberg and just did a What Are You Reading Now? And she named his book.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I said to him, I said, you can now redecorate
exactly.
your place.
That's got to be worth 30,000 sales.
And if Oprah does your book, then you can buy a new house. And he said, oh, forget it. I got Guinan.
Yeah, I guess we'll be.
Guinan is good enough. So he's younger than us.
Yes. Yeah.
So as long as he gets, you know, Guinan
right.
from Star Trek Next Gen,
yeah.
he's happy. Oprah, secondary. He's got Guinan. You know,
His publisher would be a lot happy if he got Oprah.
I think so. Yeah. They're doing Blood Pressure is the new book. Bite Marks is the first, and Blood Pressure the second.
Yeah, no, I've got that. I'm glad you reminded me of that. I've read some of the short stories. I've completely forgot that.
The novel
passed my radar when it came out. I just got some Barnes & Noble
gory.
Book cards, so I got I have to go. You know, I realized I actually had points on some credit card that I couldn't redeem as cash. So who wants travel miles when you can get book points?
Yeah,
I mean, you know, book points much better than travel miles.
Absolutely.
So now I've got free money as far as I'm concerned, and I got to add Terrence's book to that.
Yeah, yeah.
I forgot the novel came out, and then, so the second one's coming out too.
Second one is out. Oh, second one came out last week.
Oh, I can get them both. Did the first one come out a year ago then?
Yeah,
it must have been.
Yeah, a little bit more. And the trade edition is out now. Yeah.
Really wonderful writer. Terrence, pushing other writers. Terrence Taylor, pick his books up now. They're wonderful.
And I'll probably have him on again during a fun drive because he's a fabulous pitcher. It's what he does for a living.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, he produces. Okay. This is like, you know, non-commercial porn for
right,
us
right.
here at WBAI. He writes Pledge Breaks for Channel 13.
Oh,
he produces and writes the Pledge Breaks for Channel 13. Swear to God.
Just as long as he's not responsible for all the over-the-hill doo-wop acts that come on in between.
No, talk to him off the air about that.
Okay.
If you want some good stories.
Oh, I bet they're good stories.
I mean, not about the acts, but about the programming
right, stuff.
And some of the dirt.
Yeah, Terrence Taylor is a good example of what happens to your mind when it gets old. You can't remember to buy his book, but you do remember that when you took a cab, and this is an actual story, when you took a cab with him back from one of the Seaport readings 4 years ago and left the cab forgetting to – he was the last ride, so everybody had to give him his money.
And we're all Brooklyn people.
And we're all Brooklyn people. Yeah. And I, of course, get out of the cab and realize five strides from the cab that, oh, I forgot to give Terrence my $5. And it weighs on your brain so that when you see Terrence again 2 years later, the
right.
first thing you do is, oh, Terrence, I owe you $5. And he looks at you like you're out of your mind. But then much more valuable to Terrence would be buying his book. But no, old brains don't remember that. Old brains only remember the things they forgot to do. They don't remember the things they have yet to do.
Yes. It's John Armstrong, by the way, is my second reader.
Oh, okay.
Paul Whitcover's second reader. And I have to be careful about that because if I just say John, I'll say Anderson. And then I'll have to play a song from Yes after that. You know, it's like, no, it's John Armstrong. And I'm not a big Yes fan. I am a big John Armstrong fan. So.
Yes, it's a different kind of thing. That's why there was punk rock, is because of Yes. So we can thank Yes for that.
Or
or not.
Or not, yes. Maybe I should play that at some point. Old Harry Shearer bit, the Who's on first, guess who's on second. Yes is the third.
Oh, act. Right. Oh, right. I've forgotten that bit. That is a funny bit.
Oh, it's a wonderful bit.
But so you asked what I've been doing.
Enough about me.
I will be reading today from I did actually write one another novel that is connected to the Stoneways trilogy. It actually came out the way I wanted, but I was always afraid, even as I was writing it, that the way I wanted would not be particularly commercial. in that, as a couple of my beta readers said, Sam, this is all very nice, but where's the story? Where's the tension? What I did is I took I took one of my favorite characters from the Stoneways. The Stoneways is really about three people: Avender, Ferris, and Reefin. Avender, unfortunately, doesn't get his own book title until I wrote this sequel. The first book is Reefin's Choice. The second book is Queen Ferris. And the third book is not Avender. It's the Magician's Daughter. But I wrote this book called Avender in America. I always wanted to... So much fantasy involves bringing somebody from our world into a fantastic world, whether it's a fantastic world that is sort of coincident with ours, like Harry Potter, or whether it's Narnia, where it's actually a different world. A lot of fantasy involves the escape, as it were, of somebody in our world to another different fantastic world. And I always thought, well, you know, wouldn't it be great to turn that upside down and have somebody from a fantasy novel come to our world? I mean, and it's been done in pieces. There is the scene, I think, at the end of Voyage of the Dawn Treader when Prince Caspian actually makes a brief appearance in England and chastises some unruly bullies.
Is that the third book?
That's the third book.
So that's the one that should be coming out as a movie.
Are they making the third movie?
Yeah, they finally announced it.
Oh, I did not notice it.
Yeah, I thought the second movie was not bad. You didn't love it.
I didn't love it. It was too much Harry Potter-ish, and there was a lot of business that had nothing to do that was.
Completely irrelevant. It ran half an hour too long.
Exactly. They wanted more adventure and they wanted more epic scope to it.
Yeah, but my problem with the first movie is that it was too close to the book in some ways. When I read that book at first, I loved it.
Right, right.
And then as I got older, I started seeing it for the propaganda that it is. And, you know, as one gets older.
Right, right.
And so in order to enjoy the books that much more, I read them less. But when I saw the movie was such a decent adaptation of the book that I didn't love the movie because of the problems I had with the book.
You know, I can see that.
And but then, with the exception of finally Aslan makes his appearance in the second book, and in the second movie, that was too much for me. But up until that, it was darker.
Right.
And as is the book.
Well, the third one, I mean, if you want a straight out adventure story, it's probably the third and the fourth ones are the two best.
And I think that's what they decided. And so I think they are going to be making the third.
Oh, interesting.
Don't know about the fourth, but I believe they are making the third.
I mean,
third.
They originally planned to make all seven, but then, you know, they weren't received. It's like the Pullman movies.
Well, that annoys me so much because I love Pullman. He's making an appearance in New York next month, by the way, at the
To promote
library.
The new book?
Yeah. And I thought that actually talking about other movies, so many movies are usually half an hour too long. I thought that Golden Compass was about an hour too short.
Well, they never, you know, they thought they were going to have a huge hit, and they could, you know,
they
then,
should have, but they screwed it up.
Oh, that movie!
Now you see,
it was great visually, but to me, it just went nowhere.
Well, the problem with it is, it's first of all, it's very faithful to the book.
But there's no narrative.
But because they compressed it.
Yeah, yeah.
They compressed it. They say, okay, we got to get away from Oxford University, and so bang, 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 right, they're on to the next thing. But that's one of the nicest parts. They should have taken like just the Oxford University part and spent an hour there.
Right.
And then take the part with Egyptians on board the ship and taken an hour there and then taken us to the third act. It has been made very clear that 3-hour epic films will maintain a young audience,
right, right.
Or an audience of any kind. Anybody hear of Avatar? People will go see it. People will pay for it. Yeah, they will sit through it.
Jackson and Cameron are a lot better at what they do than I can't even remember the name of the guy who did the Pullman movie. Remember
Chris Weitz.
Chris Weitz. And they, I mean, there was all the thing about
and
it.
And I did not think Weitz, whose previous big film was American Pie.
Right.
I did not think he was going to do a good job. I think he did a very did good job.
But see, I think there was a lot of narrative. They just, you know, they forgot the, they forgot to tell the story.
Well, that's
they went
but
from
that's what they
scene
did.
To scene to
they,
scene.
They, but that's it. They left. But I agree. The point is, they made it too short.
Right. No, that's definitely
they made it too short. They just said, and of course they're very very afraid, and they also cut the story off.
Right.
Because they're about to get into the really heretical thing.
Right.
And this is a very controversial thing because this is a book by an atheist, written in a somewhat heretical universe.
And it's well, it's the anti Narnia. I mean, he wrote it as
absolutely.
The
well, yeah, that's his intention.
And I mean, I actually
and Narnia, who aren't for those who aren't familiar with it, is very much a Christian work.
Yeah, very Christian work. And except that I've always maintained, I didn't read Narnia until I was 13, and I got the symbolism immediately. Mm. I mean, you know, I just leapt off the page to me.
Yeah, but Sam, it didn't bother me. Grew up in a different culture than I did. What can I say?
No, but I said it didn't bother me. No, but I was certainly.
I grew up in a Holocaust survivor childhood. Okay, that's my childhood. It's,
right.
It's different. It's
yeah. No, no. There's and you know, there's
and
no
so
question
I,
you bring
so,
what your
and
your
so
cultural
I
baggage
saw,
to.
I yeah. But the point is, I saw it as non-religious. I didn't get the religious symbolism. At all, and therefore, I enjoyed it that much more.
Well, but see, I enjoyed it despite it. I mean, first of all, the sacrifice story is an old story; it's well before
yes,
Jesus.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And it is a great story. It is an excellent, excellent story. And I, you know, there's no question he was being an apologist. But I actually think Lewis is such a marvelous writer, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he has an essence of wonder almost in every sentence he writes. Which I just love, and he's a very simple writer, which I also just love.
Yes,
and he tells a story really well.
Yeah. By the way, somebody is doing a stage production again of the Screwtape Letters.
Oh, that will be interesting.
Coming up, and that I'm looking forward to. I did radio drama Screwtape Proposes a Toast.
Screwtape, for those of you who don't know, it's the letters of a master devil to a young apprentice devil, telling him, you know, basically. How to be a good devil and how not to be swayed by those angel people.
Yeah.
It is very, very amusing.
And at the end of it is a little postscript story that he wrote, which is Screwtape giving a speech in hell as an old master of the thing. And that's what Screwtape Proposes a Toast. So it was one voice with a lot of echo. And 30-something years ago, I produced that as a little radio drama.
But, well, he got a little sidetracked here. Anyway, so I wrote this story, Avenir in America, novel, which the way you know, if you want to bring somebody to our world and you want to make it, and you want to make it sure that our world, it's our world. There's no magic. It's really our world. There's no magic. There's only one way to do it, and that's with madness. So basically, I have the book begins with a Pittsburgh police officer waking up in a hospital room. After an accident at the scene of a crime, and he has no memory of himself as a Pittsburgh police officer. He thinks he's this guy, Avender from the Stoneways. And the book then is a lot about how he comes to grips with it. And I always knew the way I wanted to write, there are lots of different ways you could have written this story. You could have had it be a very picaresque novel where Avender goes off and explores the peculiarities of America and the modern world. But that's a book that's been done in many ways before. I wrote it more as an internalized book, and as such, it gets a little. It didn't work. It, as I said, it's the book I wanted to write, but it doesn't work as well as I wanted it to. However, there is some wonderful stuff in it. I think there's a very good novella in there, which when I find a good stopping point in my current science fiction project, I'm probably going to go and see if I can cull out 20,000 to 30,000 words and get the good novella out of it. And there's a wonderful scene. At one point, Avender starts writing. He starts writing fantasy stories as a way, as his psychiatrist says, as a way to cope with these memories. Why don't you write some of the stories? You know, right? And so he starts writing stories. And because he's a hero Pittsburgh police officer, he gets published a little more easily than one might otherwise be published. Tor Books comes down very hard on him because that's, you know, these characters, these are copyrighted by S.C. Butler and Tor Books. And so, you know, he ends up coming to
those people.
So he ends up coming to a convention. And his reason to come to the convention is he wants to meet me and talk to me about, you know, having written, having created his character. Because he doesn't, you know, he's mad. He doesn't quite buy the fact that, you know, I've made these things up. He thinks I'm actually stealing his stories. The piece I'm going to read is not him meeting me. That scene needs some work still. But it's my favorite scene. It's when he comes to the convention and he runs into, he goes to a sword fighting demonstration. Uh-huh. And of course, the whole idea with Avender is, you know, he's a hero from an epic fantasy. So he knows this stuff pretty cold. I mean, he's had to fight to stay alive. He's had to fight to keep his friends alive. So he knows this stuff. Do you want me to try start it now, or when do you want to do it?
We could start it now, and actually about now is the right time, but I'm wondering if you want to take a musical break briefly.
That's fine.
First.
That's fine.
So what we will do is just that. What do you want? More old jazz? You want some folky stuff? What do you want?
I'd like the jazz idea. If you like, okay. You got some jazz queued up?
I've got it available.
The joys of computer technology.
Yeah. What do you, Bix?
Bix. Play some Bix.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's see. Okay.
Here I am pretending to be a jazz aficionado when I'm really not. I know a few things.
You know a few things. Okay. How about Humpty Dumpty?
Okay.
Okay, that'll do. And we'll be back shortly. Humpty Dumpty, Bix Beiderbecke. here over listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org. The program that you are listening to is entitled Hour of the Wolf. My name is entitled Jim Freund. With me is Sam Butler, a.k.a. S.C. Butler. This is a weekly program brought to you over these airwaves since 1972 anyway. And nowadays, or at least since the 80s, has been pretty much about science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. Next week on this program, my guest will be Ellen Kushner.
Oh, Ellen's going to be here. Oh.
Yes, Ellen will be here next week. Next week, May 1st, will be my, let's see.
Hello, Ellen.
43 will be my 43rd anniversary at WBAI.
Fantastic.
Because I started May 1st, 1967. So, you know, not full time. I was 13 years old, but that's when I started as a phone volunteer. I guess I started full time, or at least as a regular volunteer, like a year and a half or 2 years later. But that was enough.
Yeah.
And I was already on the air by 068, doing little things for other people, like on Poisoned Arts and stuff like that, where apparently I was heard at that time by Michael Swanwick. And we were able to trace some of this stuff going way back.
Really?
It's very bizarre. Yeah, absolutely true.
Did Swanwick grow up in New York?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
Or at least he was hearing, I don't know if he grew up here, but he may have been at college here or something like that.
I guess that's true.
But he was
here. I knew
here,
we live here at some point.
He was here for enough of a time.
Right.
That he was hearing WBAI. I didn't even know what he was hearing, but he told me that he heard this show, Poisoned Arts, and he heard this particular episode called Train of Thought, which I'm not on, but that really influenced his writing. Janet Coleman, who is when we pay staff our arts director,
right,
and David Dozer, who do the Cat Radio Cafe show here every Tuesday. These are the people that were doing that then, and they were the people who first put me on the air on a different episode, and he heard that one. When later I got him a copy, he heard that, and he said, yeah, I heard that in the 60s. That was my radio debut.
Cool.
In 68, we believe, 1968. So at any rate, Ellen Kushner and Henry Wassels, the bookseller, will be here discussing Ellen's new book and, well, just all kinds of stuff.
Okay. So, is this the new, it's like, it's a novella, it's a short piece, the one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Here
we are, being old men again. The name is flickering out of my brain. I apologize, Ellen. I know you're not listening, but I apologize anyway.
One never knows.
One never knows. Right?
Especially because she could be listening to this next week.
That's right.
So anyhow, that's what's happening here next week. And I hope you'll all tune in for that. But listen right now.
Okay.
Sam is going to read. We were just discussing the story.
Yeah, this is from Avner in America. And to give a little, this comes late in the book. Avner at this point, he knows that he's probably not really Avner in America. And in fact, he's not really thinking of himself as Avner anymore. So you'll see this is a first person narrative, but he will go in and out. He will refer to Avner in the third person. But those are his own memories. When he is quoting what Avner thinks, those are actually his own memories. He's just doing this as a mental exercise to try and recover. The condition that the character has is something called dissociative amnesia, which is when you think your own memories are gone and replaced with false memories. He just has a very severe case of it, and the memories he's replaced his true memories with are the memories of a book, a fictional character, or rather than something else. So he is. This actually takes place at Confluence, the Pittsburgh area convention that happens in the summertime. A wonderful small regional con, and I will go from there. I looked around the room. All sorts of people were there. I recognized the boy and his mother who'd been behind me in the registration line. An old man leaned on two canes. Beside him, a woman sat in a motorized wheelchair. Another wheelchair in the corner had been wheeled into position by a friend. One man wore a full suit of armor, his visor open. Since he didn't clank when he moved, I guessed he was wearing the same sort of plastic as the Imperial Stormtrooper nearby. A few of the women pulled knitting or beadwork out of their bags as they waited for the show to begin. I should say an aside that this is very much a peen to cons and to the people who attend them, this scene. When the room was full, the smaller of the two men-at-arms stepped forward to welcome the crowd. "Hello, everybody." She spread her arms wide. Bright red cloth showed between the seams of her leathers. "You ready for a good time?" The audience clapped and cheered. "Excellent. I'm Sir Joan, and this is my boon companion and comrade-at-arms, Sir Vince." The other fighter shook his clasped hands above his head and bowed. The cheering grew. "Thank you." Sir Joan bowed as well. "Before we begin, I should tell you who we are. Sir Vince and I are members of the Cleveland Medieval Sword Club. Like you folks, we're a bunch of fantasy and gaming enthusiasts who decided to see if we could take up the real thing. It wasn't easy at first, because there aren't a lot of people around who know how to fight with longswords. At least not like Sir Vince here." Sir Vince picked up the largest sword on the table, hefted it gracefully, and twirled it in a double arc around his head. Avender had seen men try to intimidate one another that way more than once before a battle. The best thing to do was hit them with a crossbow bolt while they were still showing off. "Clubs like ours," Sir Joan went on, "have been making a lot of progress lately in understanding just how these weapons were used. A lot of the medieval and Renaissance swordmasters left behind books that describe what they knew. Now, with all the interest in fantasy and medieval culture, people are starting to study their works again. The first thing we found out is that those old Robin Hood movies, the ones with Robin and Sir Guy dueling with rapiers, aren't the way it really was at all. The true medieval weapon was the arming sword, with the long sword coming later." As Sir Joan named each weapon, Sir Vince held them up for everyone to see. Avender, of course, already knew the difference. She went on for a while. With Sir Vince's help, she described every weapon on the table. The audience watched rapt as the two fighters demonstrated the proper grip and use for each one. Avender didn't recognize all of them. He'd never seen a scimitar or a katana before, though I knew what a katana was from watching anime with the boys. But of the weapons Avender did remember, Sir Joan and Sir Vince didn't seem to always know what they were talking about. Their knowledge of arms might be broader than Avender's, but I doubted they had his experience. When all the weapons had been described, Sir Joan turned back to the crowd. "Well, what do you think, folks? Is it time for Sir Vince and me to give you a demonstration?" Judging from the roar of agreement, this was what everyone had been waiting for. Several of the younger men and women punched the air with their fists. "All right, then." Sir Joan tossed the flail she was holding back onto the stage with a loud clank. "We'll start with long swords." "And you have to remember," Sir Vince added, "people back then looked for every advantage they could find." As he spoke, he brought the flat of his blade down hard on Sir Joan's back. She fell to the floor. Though Sir Vince had pulled away from the blow at the last minute, he'd still hit her hard enough for a ringing thwack to fill the room. "Varlet," Sir Joan called from her knees, "to strike a knight unawares." "Do you yield, sir?" Sir Vince lowered the point of his blade to his companion's chin. "Never!" Knocking Sir Vince's sword away with her gauntleted hand, Sir Joan jumped to her feet and grabbed another sword from the table. For the next half minute, the two rained blows on one another. Neither fighter actually tried to penetrate the other's guard. Instead, they contented themselves with swinging roundhouse and overhead blows. Avner would have cut them both down in an instant. But I understood. They were fighting for more for show than points. The audience especially cheered the most violent cuts, or whenever one of the fighters staggered backward under the force of a blow. But eventually, Sir Vince's greater height and strength began to tell on Sir Joan. She retreated under hammering as loud as any blacksmith's. Then she fell to her knees, one hand steadying herself on the floor. "Do you yield, sir?" Sir Vince repeated, his weapon raised for a final crushing blow. "Aye," Sir Joan nodded. Lowering his weapon, Sir Vince pulled her back to her feet. I half expected her to pull some last trick on him, as he had on her in the beginning, but evidently the longsword part of the show was over. Huffing and puffing, they returned to the table and dropped their swords. "As you just saw," Sir Joan said, "the taller and stronger fighter usually wins when you're fighting with longswords. Though there's more skill than you might imagine, strength is what you really need. Since Sir Vince is a lot larger than I am, he's usually the one who wins when we use longswords. Arming swords, on the other hand, are another matter entirely." Following Sir Vince's lead, Sir Joan took up a short sword and buckler. This was more the sort of fighting Avender recalled. He'd fought with longswords on occasion, but had learned the technique only after entering King Bryzen's service. Longswords were too heavy to cart around the Veiling Mountains, and they weren't much use underground in the stoneways either. Sir Joan was much better with the short sword. She used her quickness to advantage against Sir Vince's size and reach. Still, it was a staged fight, and neither had the grace and habit with the weapon that Avender was used to. And why should they? They hadn't practiced with their weapons from the day they were strong enough to hold them. Old memories surged through me. For a moment, I forgot they weren't mine. Sir Joan's and Sir Vince's blades were as dull as their skills, too. Yet another reason neither of them were as accomplished as they might have been. As Ranner had been fond of saying when instructing Avender and Reefin, nothing like a scratch or two to teach you proper care. Or proper respect for your opponent. I suspected the two fences were showing off. Otherwise, why else would they keep turning their backs on each other? The last thing you did in a real fight was turn your back on your opponent. There wasn't a quicker way to die. But then the way these two fought was all about looking ferocious rather than being efficient. On a real battlefield, you had to dispatch your enemies as quickly as possible before they dispatched you. At least Sir Joan used her buckler as more than a shield. More than once, she punched Sir Vince's sword arm back and out of the way with it. Only his superior reach prevented her from scoring a touch when she followed with a lunge. I guessed Sir Joan was probably going to employ it as a blinder as well, making her final thrust behind the buckler. That was probably the point of the demonstration, to show that strength alone wasn't sufficient when the sword fighting became more advanced. It wouldn't be at all unlikely if Sir Joan proved superior with a rapier, too. Sure enough, feigning one way with her buckler, she lunged the other and caught Sir Vince on the shoulder with the point of her blade. Not hard enough to cut, but enough to know he'd been struck. They both lowered their weapons. Bringing their hilts to their faces, they bowed. Another round of applause followed, more vigorous than the first, especially from the women. Sir Joan and Sir Vince demonstrated several other weapons. When the fight required more strength than skill, Sir Vince usually won. But Sir Joan won all the contests that demanded skill. I wondered how she'd do against someone more practiced. What she called an arming sword had been Avender's best blade. They rested for a moment, then Sir Joan asked if anyone in the audience wanted to have a try. Hands went up immediately, especially from the man in the plastic armor. Even more than the demonstration, this was what the crowd had been waiting for. Sir Vince went first, picking a likely lad almost as big as he was. His opponent sported a brush cut and a plastic mail shirt emblazoned with a penguin brandishing a hockey stick. They fought with long swords, the young man's choice, but they barely exchanged three strokes before the older man had brought the younger to his knees. "That hurt," Sir Penguin said as he got up. The crowd laughed good-naturedly. Sir Penguin rubbed his wrists. "Who's next?" Sir Joan asked. She defeated her first opponent, a young woman even smaller than she was, as quickly as Sir Vince had defeated his. The Plastic Knight challenged her after that, but he didn't do any better than the young woman. Then it was Sir Vince's turn against the woman who ran giggling back into the crowd at the first exchange. Sir Joan followed by picking two teenage boys, arming them both with short swords and bucklers, and disarming them in less time than it takes to write about it. Plainly, she and Vince were used to people who had no idea what they were doing. Again, I wondered how they'd fare against someone who did. "Is that it?" Sir Joan glanced around the crowd, her face flushed. A few hairs slipped out from under her helm. She glanced hopefully at me for a second, then turned away at the sight of my hook. I forgot to mention before that police officer who thinks he's Avender lost his hand in an accident. He sports now a prosthetic. I think she was looking for someone large to make a fool of. "Come on, people. We still have another 15 minutes. When are you going to have a chance to try sword fighting again? Who knows? You might even get lucky." "I'll give it a try," I said. I think it was the look she'd given me that made me volunteer. Just because I had a hook didn't mean I was handicapped or that I couldn't take her. I knew it made no sense. What did I know about sword fighting? That was Avender's memory. But I remembered everything he'd ever done, and my hand itched to hold one of those swords. And Avender's memory had helped me learn how to use my hook, hadn't it? "I don't think so," she said. It wouldn't be fair. "I could take it off, you know," I said, raising my hook. That got a laugh from the crowd. "Or I could wear a buckler." That's not what I meant. Sir Joan didn't like the crowd taking my side at all. "With one hand, you're at a real disadvantage." "You said anyone could try," I reminded her. "That's right," called someone, the woman in the motorized wheelchair. "Let him have a chance. Maybe he's better than you think." "I'll fight him," Vince offered. "Yeah," shouted a man in a Darth Vader t-shirt. "That'd really be fair." "I don't care who I fight," I said, "as long as I fight someone." "Give him a chance. Yeah, maybe he's good. You go, Luke." That got the biggest laugh from the crowd yet. They started chanting the name over and over. "Luke, Luke, Luke," egging Sir Joan on. though I'd watched the Star Wars movies with the boys, I didn't get what they were saying until someone called out, "I am your father!" The crowd roared. Sir Joan made up her mind. Setting her mouth, she said, "All right, what weapons do you want to use?" "Short swords and bucklers. Pick what you want from the table." Though it was only Abner's memory, both blade and buckler felt natural in my hand, more natural than footballs or baseball bats that I'd played with the boys. Neither were particularly well-crafted. The balance wasn't right, and I couldn't use the buckler at all unless I held it close to my body. Extending my arm caused my hook to release, which made me drop the buckler. I locked the metal fingers in place, so that wouldn't be a problem. It might have been easier if I'd removed the hook, but I'd have had to take my shirt off to do that, and I was already self-conscious enough. "Have you ever done this sort of thing before?" whispered Sir Joan, as she collected her own equipment from the table beside me. "A little," I whispered. If I'd stopped to think about it, I would have been sure my confidence was misplaced. But I was enjoying the sensation so much, I didn't bother. It had been a long time since I'd felt so sure of myself. A thrill of strength and skill surged through me as Sir Joan and I took our places on the floor. The first bout ended quickly. We saluted one another, and then, as soon as Sir Joan took up her position, I attacked. I didn't even have to think about what I was doing. It just came naturally to me, the way I suppose throwing a football must have come naturally to me before I lost my memory. My sword flashed in three directions, and then I'd forced Sir Joan's arm up and to the side. Her sword skittered across the floor. The crowd burst into cheers. Sir Joan's eyes narrowed. "Who are you?" she asked under her breath. "Did Ethelmark send you to make us look bad?" "What's Ethelmark?" I asked. "Don't pretend you don't know. You're too good." "Maybe I just got lucky. Want to try another pass?" She retrieved her sword from the crowd and faced me again. This time there was no slackness in her eyes or wrists. This time she was ready for my attack. The crowd waited. No one dared to breathe. I waited as well, knowing that Sir Joan would expect another slashing strike. But you don't win battles or duels by doing the same thing twice. So this time I waited for her. "Come on," she said, beckoning with her sword and buckler. "I'm ready for you." "I thought I'd let you attack this time," I said. "All right." She came at me in a rush. I'd seen worse. Or I should say, Abner had seen worse. But he'd seen a lot better, too. Letting her come closer than she thought I would, I stepped to one side, caught her sword between my buckler and the hilt of my blade, and pulled it out of her hand. The crowd cheered even louder than before. "What the hell was that?" she demanded. "That's not a legal move." "Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize there were rules." "Of course there are rules. Somebody could get hurt. That's the whole point, isn't it?" "No, it isn't. What do you think this is, medieval France?" "It's a sword fight. The whole point of sword fighting is to win." "Let me try, Joan," Sir Vince said. "What he needs to fight someone his own size." "Yeah," shouted someone in the crowd. "Bring it on! Luke, Luke, Luke!" They were all on my side as Sir Vince took Sir Joan's place. I don't know why he thought he could do any better. I was bigger than he was, and had already proven I was better with a short sword than Sir Joan, unless they'd just been pretending before in order to let her win. They hadn't. Vince tried to overpower me with brute force. I stood my ground for his first two rushes. On the third, I stepped aside and touched him on the chest. Then I attacked and disarmed him with only a little less difficulty than I had his companion. "Jesus!" Sir Vince stood panting, his hands on his knees. "Who are you?" "Luke Skywalker!" someone cried. I almost said my real name, but decided I should keep to the spirit of the event. "Sir Avender of Vailing and Goose Rock." The crowd's cheers grew deafening. Sir Vince offered me his hand. "Good to meet you, Sir Avender. Join us in the bar later, and I'll buy you a beer." That's a good place to stop.
All righty. And here I was, you know, looking for the segue to go out and hadn't found one yet because I thought we had a little ways to go. That's wonderful.
Thank you. Yeah, the story works, I think, in this part. There's you get a real feel for the dichotomy in his head and for, you know, what I'm trying to write, as I said, it was a bit of a paean to fantasy and science fiction conventions and fans and us. I mean, I'm a fan. Jim's a fan. We start out reading this stuff. You're always a fan first. Yeah. And trying to describe, you know, what it's like to be at a con and how much fun people have. And, I mean, there are scenes where, you know, some of the odd moments of cons are played up a little more than this one is in the book. And, you know, because you're trying to express, you know, so often you tell somebody, "Oh, I'm off to a convention," you know, and they think, "Oh, you know, it's, you know, you're going off to a boiler salesman's convention or a Shriners convention."
Yeah, that's the thing is that it's not When I go to what other people might call conventions in the computer world, it's a trade show.
Yes.
These aren't, you know, they may behave like it, but they're not fans of the stuff,
right.
unless they're like executives with particular companies, and those are in days of yore. But the science fiction conventions, which include fantasy, horror, etc., but we call them science fiction conventions, are a subculture and have been a major subculture in this country and England, where to a large extent they really started for. Is it 100 years now? Not quite.
When was the first world science fiction convention? It was in the 30s, wasn't it?
Yes.
In New York?
I think so. Yeah. I think so, yeah. But before there were world cons, there were fanzines.
Oh, right, yeah. Fanzines. Fanzines were certainly go back a century.
Yes. And George Bernard Shaw wrote for a zine. H.G. Wells ran a number of zines.
Oh, I didn't know that.
H.P. Lovecraft, of course, had the Lovecraft Circle. And his zines brought forth, for example, Ray Bradbury. Ray Bradbury, as a young teenager, was reading a fanzine published by H.P. Lovecraft.
Well, that's interesting.
Directly.
I did not know that.
And that's what brought Bradbury into the fold. So Bradbury comes out of fandom. And that's, well, many, many years ago. So, yeah, fandom can make a claim in its, you know, some might say it's pre-fandom, whatever.
Right, right.
And, of course, there are people who will maintain that there's fanzine fandom versus con fandom. Some people straddle both worlds. Moshe Feder, who we were talking about on our way here,
right.
I mean, he can tell you all about the world of fanzine fandom, and there are people that, for them, that's all of
right.
what fandom is.
But
it's very much a part of who we are.
And it was, for me growing up, I had no idea this stuff existed.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew was that there was this stuff called science fiction written by Andre Norton and Heinlein.
Whoever he was.
Yeah, whoever he was. And H.G. Wells and Verne that I could find in my, in my school library. And in the, in the New York Public Library. And because I was just not, I didn't have family in the scene. It was my parents, always wanted. When was I going to grow up and stop reading that science fiction and fantasy stuff? Actually, even back then, there wasn't even fan. It was just that science fiction stuff.
Again, you and I are of an age where that was disdained and looked down upon, where I was failed in a class for writing a book report on the Martian Chronicles just on the grounds that it was that literature.
Oh, let's see. I had a very interesting school experience.
And, of course, my great revenge was interviewing Bradbury.
And telling him the story?
No, not just telling him the story, having him record a message for that teacher.
Oh, excellent.
On the weekend that he was getting the National Book Award.
Oh, excellent.
For Fahrenheit 451.
That is fantastic.
I mean, I got the ultimate wet dream revenge, like Gene Shepard-type revenge. It was fabulous.
Yeah. No, I was lucky. I went to a school that actually, I only got that from my parents. I never got it at school. The school I went to loved kids to read, especially boys, anything. And so, they might catch you reading a comic during math class, and though they would confiscate the comic, the teacher would say to you afterwards, "Well, you like the, why don't you try this book called The Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas? It's kind of like
that." No, that was in Cambridge?
No, this is growing up in New York City.
Oh, in New York,
I was growing up in New York City. No, I grew up in New York City too, and I was very lucky that way, and so... the school, you read Tarzan of the Apes, they didn't care as long as you were reading.
You see, I guess it depends on the school. We're of the same age, but my school in Queens, that was not, or at least my sixth grade
teacher.
It's the teacher.
That's even more than the school, it's the teacher.
Yeah, yeah.
Our teacher actually read sometimes. He would occasionally.
Because my mother-in-law, Barbara's mother, who's a school teacher, she would have promoted.
Right.
She would have embraced
and
very same thing.
It all depends on the teacher. And you know what? Reading is reading. And it doesn't matter whether you're reading, what is considered good for you or considered bad for you. It's still reading. It's still a mental exercise that is very good for you. And too often, I think schools today, schools throughout history have, you know, because schools are not just about teaching you the elements of education. They're teaching you about moral fiber and things like that, too. So they like to try and pick books that will make you a better citizen. And, you know, often, especially for boys, you know, 11-year-old boys don't want to read books that, you know, make a better citizen. They want to read books that have, you know, swords in them and Martians and maybe farting, you know. That's what boys like. And, you know, why shouldn't boys read what they're going to like? And if you want them to read more, then you got to get them to read books that they like.
Yeah, but what I'm discovering now as I have, you know, next generation writers on the show, the people who are, you know, N.K. Jemisin's age, Saladin Ahmed, all these people who I have Matt Kressel, the people of that ilk who are in the Altered Fluids group and all that. These are they are in their 20s and 30s.
Right.
And they grew up being encouraged to read this stuff. They don't know of a world where what was that Buck Rogers stuff became that Star Trek stuff became there was a slight descent into Star Wars. I'm not putting any of these down. I'm just saying that this was the social view of it all. And I have little doubt. And what would have been the Doctor Who badness of the 60s will become the Doctor Who goodness of the early 21st century.
Of the aughts.
Of the aughts.
No, it's
by the way, tonight's episode, not a bad one, not a bad one. Next week's episode could have been good, but it's just standard Dalek stuff. Tonight in England, Professor Riversong makes return with the Weeping Angels. Ooh, looking forward to that. Sorry.
Should be good.
My fanboy really coming through there.
Fanboy, yeah. No, I never really got into Doctor Who. I think bad as the original, because I was a huge original Star Trek fan.
Mm-hmm.
How could I not be? You know, I was the right age in the right place, the right time. And bad as the production values were for the original Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Original Doctor Who episodes, which I think probably came to the U.S. a few years later.
Oh, many years later, about 15 years later.
Oh, I thought, weren't they broadcast in the U.S. in the 70s?
Yes, with...
No, but I mean a few years after Star Trek. So it's about 10 years
Star Trek. The Doctor Who began in 1960.
Yeah, no.
It came here about 76.
Oh, so okay. So it was about 10 years between original Star Trek and Who showing up over here.
Yeah. And also Doctor Who was showing up here on originally on Channel 9,
right.
WOR, yeah. As a Saturday morning show,
right.
Kiddie show, which of course it really is.
Yeah. But, you know, even compared to Star, I mean, the original Who's are really primitive.
Oh, absolutely.
They are really, really primitive. And, you know, I had sort of, you know, oh, I'm past that now. I'm 20-something, and it's got to be a little bit
better
production.
They were so primitive that the BBC didn't bother keeping copies.
Right,
you know, that was it. It's like, you know, put them on the forklift, out the door. So many of them don't exist.
Right. But they have so many cool ideas in them. I mean, it's...
A lot of them were seminal, but they were done on...
A shoestring.
An absolute shoe. And even when it became popular.
Half a shoestring.
By the time that they were up to the fourth Doctor, to Tom Baker, which is my favorite Doctor, and I think their best era, when Douglas Adams was the story editor and all this wonderful stuff was going on, the BBC Radiophonic Workshop doing incredible sound work and all
right.
that behind. Nevertheless, the monsters are made out of bubble wrap. And that's not an exaggeration.
They make Japanese 50s monsters look like state-of-the-art animation, state-of-the-art CGI.
But of course, Japanese 50s monsters are making movies, and this is a weekly TV show. Now, so when Doctor Who came back in 2005 with high production values, it was a whole different thing. And now they're on to the third Doctor of the reborn Who, with Matt Smith and a new writer and story editor, Stephen Moffat. So it's a whole new ball game.
Right.
So what's being broadcast tonight on BBC America is only the second episode.
Now, I don't know my Who well enough. Have they ever completely re-engineered the series, or is it always continuity to the old shows? I mean,
there's always continuity.
Yeah, so they have.
This is the 11th Doctor. Yeah. And while every Doctor is reborn and is a different individual, the Doctor also has the memories of all the previous ones. So everyone is both a reboot but harkens back.
So they've never actually fully rebooted the way Batman gets rebooted and Star Trek gets rebooted.
No, there's always a certain – well, and they don't have to because the rebooting is built in. So they have the choice. And no, this Doctor doesn't necessarily harken back completely to William Hartnell or something like that. But and also you have the beauty of it's being a Time Lord.
Right.
So if somebody goes back and meets Shakespeare, who's to say that which Doctor is it that meets him for the first time?
Right, right.
It's all a question of where in the chronology does it fall? Does it flow? And there are, and right now there's something very mysterious going on with the continuity in the world, which people will see a little bit of tonight and next week with the Daleks. Even more, there's a very interesting mystery that will be the big season arc when we discover that everybody on Earth should know the Daleks, because the Daleks have taken over the Earth at least two or three times in Doctor Who. But we discover that Amy, our new companion for the Doctor, has never heard of the Daleks. That's impossible. And we're not told why.
Are you seeing these in advance? Okay. You seem very knowledgeable, but I didn't know if these were repeats or not.
No. I have seen shows that have not yet been broadcast in this country. I have friends in England.
Very helpful.
Yes.
Very helpful to have friends.
So I have already seen next week's show.
Okay. So you're about a week ahead each time?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. So.
Who is Doctor Who is something I've got to start watching, getting the continuity of. I've been going through a long period. My wife is a huge Star Trek fan.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been going through a long period of watching all of Star Trek, the complete canon.
I drop out after DS9, basically.
As well you should. I did not say that this was necessarily a good thing.
And even the end of DS9 had problems.
Well, it's the usual mainstream science fiction problem of, you know, it always has to come back to religion, doesn't it? DS9 ends with a religious arc.
Yeah, although I liked some of the religious stuff that they did with the religion on the planet and that whole Louise Fletcher thing.
Right, right.
Where you had that religion and
religion is politics as opposed to just miracles.
That was very well done, some of that. But what
very
but,
well done.
But making, you know, they had sown the seeds for Sisko to be in touch with aliens that were seen as the religious masters of this planet, and ending up with, you know, for he is the Kwisatz Haderach, basically. He is a messiah, I thought was utterly gratuitous and unnecessary, and would never have happened if they weren't going into their finishing their seventh season.
Right.
My problem with DS9, I'll tell you exactly when it jumped the shark, when they brought in the Defiant.
Oh, that was the super ship, right?
Yeah, well, the idea that they had a ship at all.
Yeah.
The whole point of DS9 was Casablanca in space.
Right, right.
And here, of the continuing adventures, remember there was a crossover. There were two seasons when Next Gen and DS9 were both on the air at the same time.
Right.
And so you had the ongoing adventures of the Enterprise, and then you had this one world that the Federation was trying to make a foothold in, where all these different aliens were meeting, and that was the idea of the Casablanca in space. And keep it bound there. The moment that they brought in a ship and all of a sudden our protagonists are no longer around that planet, they're no longer on DS9, they're no longer on the station, they're whizzing around the world, the galaxy.
They fell back into the tried and true.
But they didn't do it as well. It just didn't work.
Well, but, and, you know, even... They're,
even though they transfer over members of the Next Gen, you know, they bring over
Worf,
the Klingon
Worf
chief.
Shows up.
Yeah, and the chief.
Oh, that's right.
Colmeny's there from the start.
Yeah, he's from the start.
Yeah.
That's a common Star Trek problem when they, you know, how many episodes have to do with two members of the crew going off somewhere in a shuttlecraft, often for a vacation.
But when they did that on Next Gen, it generally worked.
But it's also so completely implausible within the actual structure. I always wonder, you really watch a lot of those shows and you wonder, did the people who do this actually have any idea of command structure, of what is and what is not plausible with a ship? I mean, the whole idea that, there's a first officer, but there's no second officer or third officer.
Yeah.
There are no watches. The ensign, ensigns have as much responsibility as lieutenants.
And little kids can sit on the bridge.
And little kids can sit on the bridge. And I don't know. I should. Star Trek is old hat. We shouldn't be talking about old hat stuff.
But the thing is, it's constantly remembered. And there's one that's completely rebooted.
Yes, and which was a lot of fun. Not badly at all.
I thought that was going to be an awful movie. And I'm not a J.J. Abrams fan.
Right, right.
And I just rewatched that movie. It was better the second time. It really holds up.
When I wrote a brief post on that, and.
I read your post.
Yeah. I think I said something along the lines of stupid. I loved it.
Yeah.
I mean, because it was. It was stupid. It was like the original show in a lot of ways.
It did what the original show was supposed to do.
It brought the fun back to Star Trek.
It really did. It had all of that. There was one major point that they missed that I won't – I mean red matter.
Yeah.
Well, and we know why they did red matter, because – what should have been
in its hand wavium. It's hand wavium.
But you see, they were going to do something much, much better. I'll talk to you about this off the air, because otherwise I'll be getting phone calls from people I don't want to get phone calls from.
Right, I understand.
Speaking of phone calls.
Absolutely.
If you'd like to call up and speak with Sam Butler about his writing and, things in general, obviously we've gone far afield.
We do tend to want.
We haven't even mentioned the B word.
No, we have not.
And that's all right. It's just, Sam is here now every April.
It happens every spring.
Yes, exactly. But we don't have
We're dating ourselves again just mentioning that title.
Oh, well, dating, though, that's before we were born.
That's true. But does anybody, any of those people, Matt Kressel, N.K. Jemisin, do you think they have any idea what we're talking about when we say it happens every spring?
It depends on how much they watch classic movies.
That's true.
Do you, Simon?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, good. Ray Milland. Okay.
Ray Milland is a baseball pitcher, sort of.
Well, sort of, yeah. Well, yeah, he pitches baseball. He does. He's not owning he's not taking care of the cat that owns the team.
No.
That's a different movie. That's Rhubarb.
Oh, right. I haven't thought of that one.
Well, you see, that's very important to me, because I grew up in Jackson Heights, and so did Rhubarb.
Oh, Rhubarb. I didn't know Rhubarb.
Rhubarb by H. Allen Smith is a cat in the country club, in the Jackson Heights Country Club, which was a place that as a little kid I knew.
There was a country club in Jackson? Was it actually in Jackson Heights?
Absolutely.
Where was it?
Jackson Heights, Long Island, as it was. Oh, it was on Northern Boulevard, between Northern Boulevard and 32nd Avenue, about, in the 70s.
So it was like tennis and maybe a pool?
Oh, a big tennis court, huge pool, huge, you could go dine there. I was too young.
Right.
But the idea of Rhubarb is he's the cat who goes and chases the tennis balls in the Jackson Heights Country Club. And I don't think I ever went into the country club. But the playground that I went to was right next to the country club. And so I do remember it going back then. But these are in the days of Jackson Heights, Long Island, where Jackson Heights was a resort developed by, largely,
don't know,
Helen Kane.
Wait, the name rings a bell, but I'm not placing it.
Okay, I can play us a Helen Kane song if you like.
That would be good.
Please.
Oh, okay. Do we have time? I'm not going to play the whole thing. Okay, here's Helen Kane. All right. I won't even lower our mics. This is Helen Kane. And when
you brought that up awful quickly. Had you already cued it?
No, not at all. But I have my 30s music
here.
Oh,
that's true.
That's Helen Kane.
Okay. Betty Boop's based
the
on
Betty Boop was based on her, and she did the voice in the first three cartoons.
Oh, she
and
did.
And then there was a huge court case between Helen Kane and Paramount Pictures, which Helen Kane, you know, she wanted to be paid
right.
for being Betty Boop, and they said, no, we could get Mae Questel. And eventually, Helen Kane lost the suit. Today, she'd never lose. She'd own her image and voice and property. But she wasn't the first person to say boop, boop, doop. But here's her signature. This is one of her signature songs. One second. That's Helen Kane.
Well, didn't they play that song in the first Betty Boop cartoon? One of the Betty Boop cartoons does the song, I think.
They do, but later. No, the first cartoon is called Dizzy Dishes, 1929. God, why do I know this stuff? Or maybe 1930. And she's a dog.
Oh, right. I remember that.
She's created for Bosco. She's a companion for Bosco. And then her long ears become the earrings and become the Betty Boop trademark. Yep. And I don't remember what the song is in Dizzy Dishes. But at any rate, so Betty Boop is basically eventually forced out of the movie business and the music business. She wasn't gorgeous. She did about three live-action films. And they're terrible films. And she hooked up with a realty guy. And she basically helped develop Jackson Heights.
Unbelievable.
And when I was a little kid, going back to the Jackson Heights stuff, I would take rent checks over to Helen Kane. My parents would write checks out to the Helen Kane Corporation.
That's fascinating. I never heard that story.
The Zoftig little Jewish lady, you know, and I'd give this woman here. That's my landlady there. Okay, so
some landlady.
And she was largely responsible for the development of Jackson Heights. You look in Wikipedia, they don't tell that story, but I've heard this story from any number of sources now. And it jives when you read the history. When you read the history of Helen Kane, they tell the story. But not when they tell the story of the history of Jackson Heights. They talk all about the developer. But that was...
That's an interesting.
So that goes. So that all ties into baseball movies.
Baseball movies.
There we go. Telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And boy, are we getting a lot of calls. Are they all about Jackson Heights? I don't think so. Good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
This is the caller from Bulgaria. If you.
Oh, hi. How are you doing? We've got a very good connection this time.
Well, it's not late enough over here, and it's quite early over there, so I guess that helps, maybe.
Yeah, but the last couple of times you called, there was a lot of problems with your voice over internet line.
Well, it was an entirely different voice over internet setup than this time, so...
Ah, well, this one's better.
Okay, I'll keep that in mind.
What time is it in Bulgaria?
Well, we're 7 hours in the future in terms of New York, so it's, let me check.
2 o'clock.
It's quarter to two in the p.m. of Saturday, the 24th.
Okay. Yeah, same day here, but early in the morning.
Yep. The thing I wanted to mention is the early Doctor Who episodes that were lost.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there were any forklifts involved. My understanding is that it was very early use in television industry of magnetic tapes, which were reusable.
Right. The majority of them were just reused on the very earliest ones were kinescopes. And then they went to videotape, and they reused a lot of those tapes. But the reason I used the term forklift is because there was a documentary actually on the life of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop.
And I'm not sure I want to hear this story, but go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. Well, actually, it has a happy ending. Where all of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop did all the sound effects and all the music for the earliest Doctor Who's right through the later years and the people who worked on who were able to use them, which is why the BBC Radiophonic Workshop does all the sound in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy when Douglas Adams was doing both Doctor Who and Hitchhikers. And for those people who don't remember, Hitchhikers was first radio drama, later a book, 4 years later. It's radio drama first with the BBC Radiophonic Workshop coming out of Doctor Who studios. Let's remember that about Hitchhiker. So anyway, the there was a person talking about how they were taking all the tapes of the history of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop and putting them all onto a forklift in order to get rid of them. And they were saved last moment. But that same person said that those same people, at some point when they found some of the old kinescopes, which were not reusable, of the Doctor Who's, they were just thrown out.
Well, I don't know. I got a DVD set of the very, very first Doctor Who series from 1963.
Yeah, that DVD came out about a year ago, called The Early Years, yeah.
No, not The Early Years. It's just the first couple of serials.
Oh, okay.
Of the first Doctor. And the BBC DVD, I've had it for 3 or 4 years now.
Okay, because BBC came out with another one about a year ago called called The Early Years with William Hartnell in it.
Anyhow, there's additional material on the DVD, and they were saying how, well, they were the first to use magnetic tapes to actually record the show in 1963. And because of that, well, some of the magnetic tapes got lost because of being reused. And that's how I...
Yeah, they didn't value them is really what it came down to. And mind you, this was true right through the John Pertwee years.
Well, I haven't gotten into Doctor Who as much as I would have liked. I've watched the first from the 1960s, the first few, but not as... I wanted to go through the entire thing to catch up with the story.
There are some DVDs that you can rent that have pretty much every Doctor. The first Doctor, of course, is William Hartnell, and then Patrick Troughton, then John Pertwee, then
Tom
Baker.
A best of introduction I want.
Well, there is no complete.
A completist.
There is no... What they have is they have what you can get through underground circles or what they call recons. Fans have the scripts. They have photographs. They have the sound of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And they build these reconstructions of what the episodes must have been like. That's the only way anybody can get all of Doctor Who.
They need to do what I just saw on YouTube, but they're doing for Star Trek. For the original Star Wars movie.
Mm-hmm.
Fans have submitted 15-second scenes. Everybody does a 15, they do their own 15-second
version.
Yeah, but they do a 15-second version, whether they use, you know, Lego toys or they act themselves. And then they put together, I don't know, it's like 500 of these 15-second sections, all of done independently of each other, to make this actually completely bizarro, but completely narratively complete version of Star Wars. So maybe somebody needs to do that for Doctor Who.
Interesting. So I wanted to say your guest said something about looking for a decent digital reader, and I have gotten recently a 7.6-inch by 5.9-inch device, which has an 8-inch diagonal thing. It's not a screen, is it?
It looks about the right size.
Well, yeah.
Well, if you have a large enough pocket, it is pocket-sized.
Yeah, and right. Yeah.
Shall I mention the...
It's got to be thin.
Oh, yeah, sure. Here. Go ahead. Mention the brand.
Well, IREX does this. IREX Digital Reader 800S is the one I'm speaking about.
I'll take a look at it.
Those have gotten very good reviews. Yeah.
I love it so much. I try to keep down on my paper book purchases now to balance the budget from the purchase, but it's really nice to it's a pocket-sized thing where I've been able to load thousands and thousands of pages of books I should read at some point, but it's really convenient that nearly half the weight of the iPad thing.
Yeah.
iPad's too big. For my purposes, iPad's too big.
Well, the Direx I mentioned is 360 grams, and the iPad is 680 and above.
Mm-hmm.
So it's half the size of the iPad in weight. And it's a wonderful sized screen because it's small enough to be easy to handle, and it's significantly larger than the 16-inch devices that you may have seen or not. It's really great, no, I think. But
it sounds good, and I've heard good things about it, although I haven't actually seen one.
I'll have to look for one.
Well, thanks for calling. We only have 4 minutes left.
Well, thanks for the show, and keep up. I'll try and listen again next week.
Okay, great. Take care.
Have fun.
You too. And see, that's the thrill, by the way, when people say, oh, we have so many problems with the internet, just get rid of the internet broadcast, then I can't get phone calls from Bulgaria.
No.
Right? That's always exactly. A thrill. Good morning, you're on the radio. Yellow.
Oh, yeah. Hi, good morning.
Hi there. We only have a couple of minutes.
Can you hear me?
We only have a couple of minutes.
Right. I have a 10-year-old that he likes to read Harry Potter books, and my wife kind of scared that those books are, you know, like, scary books. But your guest was saying that you should allow the kids to read whatever they enjoy to read. So I'm kind of wondering that is that okay for him to read that kind of books? And
of course.
Well, and, can you tell us more what kind of book do you know? Will be interesting for the kids on different range?
Well, the first thing that you have to ask yourself is how old is your child? What is your child like? It's, reading is, it's not one size fits all. It's in fact, that's one of the beauties of reading is that there's so many sizes available and so many different books available that you can find different, you can find anything for anybody. There are children who are scared to death of anything, and then you don't have them read Harry Potter. Or Harry Potter is by no means even remotely the scariest.
It's not safe. But then again, no fairy tale is.
Right, yeah. The nature of fairy tales is that they're cautionary in a lot of ways. And cautionary means that they're going to go to bad places. They're not going to caution you about good places because that's not necessary. So it really depends what the age of the child is, what the reading level of the child is, and what the child's preferences are, and also what your preferences are. I have the children drinking beer from a fairly young age because in their medieval society, that's what would have happened. It would have been a very watered down beer, and I had people tell me that I can't have my 12-year-old read this book. You have 12-year-olds drinking beer, and. That's your prerogative. It's your prerogative not to read the book for whatever reason you want, and just as it's somebody's prerogative to read it for whatever reason they want as well.
But I think there's also another question, which is there are a lot of people that are protective to a certain point, and they say, oh no, this has dark, dangerous stuff. And I ask them to take a look at the Grimm's fairy tales, the Grimm's household tales, filled with blindings, decapitations, and things like that.
A lot of feet getting chopped off.
Oh, yeah, constantly. In Cinderella, you've got toes.
Ooh, the original version.
Oh, if it's not Disney-fied, it's pretty gory stuff and pretty frightening stuff. And it's intended to be, and this is a very good way, I think, for kids to learn how to face the world.
Right. That's what those stories were meant to be.
Uh-huh. Okay, it sounds good. He's only 10 years old, but he enjoys it. He's a fast reader, and I listen to your show all the time. So,
well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Okay, bye now.
Bye-bye. Well, it's... As always, just as things are not, well, things were getting moving, but as we want them to continue moving, we're out of time. So we need to tell people that the works of Sam Butler, S.C. Butler is the name that appears on the books. The Stoneways trilogy, which by name are Refn's Choice, Queen of Pharisee, I always have to look at that one, and The Magician's Daughter are all in print.
All in print.
Start
in
with
many,
Reefman's
many.
Choice.
Yeah, it does. The last one's a little bit standalone, but the first two you gotta read the first two, and then the third one is certainly better if you read the first two.
Yeah, and we will do this again. And what can I say other than thanks for being here?
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's always a delight. It's always a great conversation.
Okay, great. And and your website, or your at least your LJ.
The website's www.veilingstoneways.com, all one word.
V-A-L-I-N-G, Stoneways.
And I don't even know what my live journal is. scbutler@livejournal.com, I guess, is what
it
is.
Yeah, I think it's scbutler.livejournal.com.
Yeah. And it's actually my, since I don't have anything coming out, I've somewhat let Veiling Stoneways slide a bit. It's actually not much more than a blog right now.
Might as well go to the LJ.
So might as well go to the LJ.
Yeah.
Okay. I post more frequently there.
Well, so thank you all for listening. Ellen Kushner and Henry Wessels here next week. And thank you again, Sam.
Thank you.
And good morning, everybody. Stay tuned for As I Please with Simon Locally.
You are tuned to WBAI 99.5 FM here in New York City. And time is now 7 o'clock. And welcome once again to As I Please for this, the 24th day of April in the year 10. And greetings one and all. Well, I am pleased to say that I have received from a variety of sources clippings, notes, accounts of the Twain centenary, or centenary, I guess we have a variety of pronunciations, the 100th anniversary of the death of Mark Twain, which occurred this past Wednesday. And I am pleased to say that I believe Hal Holbrook is still on the road doing Mark Twain Tonight, although I suppose he may be forgiven if in the last few weeks he may have taken some time off due to family circumstances. But I just got to say that the winner, the winner is, you know, you're not supposed to say winner now, the one that received perhaps the most note from me, more than a mere eyebrow raising, came from... David, are you ready? It came from David. David is one of my listeners way out in St. Louis, Mo. Shemp and Curly. And sent an article about a man in Hannibal, Missouri. I think you may figure, well, there must be a connection. And this man is a Mark Twain lookalike. Well, that's not so hard if you're of a certain height and you've got a certain amount of hair and a big walrus mustache. A lot of people would think that you look like Mark Twain. He has been living on this lookalike quality for quite some time in Hannibal, Missouri, but he is not even a Mark Twain impersonator. He is most certainly not a Mark Twain performer. He's just a guy who happens to look like Mark Twain, and he would wander around the tourist traps of Hannibal, saying, "Hey, I look like Mark Twain, give me some money." Well, I am pleased to report that this gentleman has been given the bum's rush from Hannibal, Missouri, because, well, there are responsible impersonators and performers to be found there, but this fella, he was just going for the ride because of a... because if Jesus happened to look a little like Mark Twain, and he is now heading off to Bronson, Missouri. Bronson, Missouri, to make oodles of money there. And, of course, I have mixed feelings about this. Obviously, I should include myself among Mark Twain performers. However, I make a point of not trying to dress up like Mark Twain or not trying to do anything that gives the illusion that the real man is there before you because, well, Hal Holbrook does it. There you go. But then there are those impersonators, people who dress up in the role but may have little or no knowledge about the subject they are impersonating, as is this lookalike in Hannibal. And, you know, I'm beginning to say, now, far be it from me to be strict and puritanical, but by gum, by gosh, by golly, we're going to have to do something about this. And I'm going to write an angry letter to whoever, insisting that we license our impersonators. Yes, if you are going to dress up like Mark Twain or Elvis Presley or Marilyn Monroe, it behooves you to have a little bit of knowledge about the person you are dressing up like, by gum, by gosh. Now, this is a severe step. But it is clear that we cannot allow these people to police themselves. Clearly something has to be done to make sure that when you have somebody dressed up as Mark Twain before you, you'll get something that at least was written by Mark Twain. Is that too much to ask? I think not. But then, of course, this is my axe that I am grinding. Well, let's see what we can do this morning. And in a day and age when nothing really matters anymore. Good morning. Welcome aboard. We'll just dive in. We'll see what happens. It is quite true. As I Please has secret agents around the world, even in St. Louis, Mo. Well, maybe I should do this now. Play my little song for my colleagues gathering on the scenic and chilly corner of 8th Avenue and 50th Street, where the bus rides begin and where ultimately they end, and it always takes a heck of a lot longer than you would expect or want. Any case, Saturday morning is a time when the day starts quickly. You know, traffic is light, but it just builds and builds and builds. And so the least I can do, since they think this is like time off, they think that I am just relaxing. They think that I'm having the time of my life and that nothing happens. You know, it doesn't take, all I have to do is get up, roll out of bed, and roll into the studio and blah, 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 blah. That is not the case, but that's what they think. And the least I can do is say, you may be wrong, but I likes you anyway. So for the early birds on the curb, enjoy this. Ben and the Boys, and T for Two, the great Ben Webster on tenor sax, Hot Lips Page, the great Hot Lips Page. You know, with a name like Hot Lips Page, don't you want to know more about him? Hot Lips Page on trumpet, my beloved Clyde Hart on piano, a sideman who died way too young, which is, alas, all too common in jazz history. Charlie Drayton on bass and Denzel Best on drums. Ben and the Boys, T for Two, September 1943, recorded here in New York City. One of the things that really annoys me in this world, and boy, oh boy, sometimes it feels like everything really annoys me. One of the things that really annoys me these days is the sort of the mystique around coffee. And I see people day in and day out lining up at Starbucks, coming out of Starbucks with these huge containers of coffee, which they sort of sip and walk at the same time, which just seems to me, you know, if you want to have coffee, sit down and enjoy it, for crying out loud. What are you proving that you're walking and drinking at the same time, you know? So you're not Gerald Ford. Big deal. However, this mystique about coffee means that these people are willing to pay oodles of money because, well, Starbucks has this reputation. Although I have never had a cup of Starbucks coffee, I can tell you right now that the coffee I make at home is much better. And why? Because it's prepared with loving care. You know, you see people going out and getting those French press, which is really sort of easy. Coffee made simple, right? Because you don't have to do anything. You throw the grounds in, you throw boiling water, and you let it sit for a couple minutes. That, friends, that is cowboy coffee. If you want real coffee, then you're going to have to make a step beyond the French press system. And I recommend, in fact, I insist upon, drip. Drip alone.